You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @PolicyPodcasts.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Africa Security Initiative in the Foreign Policy Program, and we're delighted today to have a discussion on the upcoming elections in Kenya, which, as you undoubtedly know, are only a couple weeks away. August 8th, I believe, is the looming date. And so a very important election, obviously, for Kenya's future. And I'm joined by a fantastic panel of scholars and experts, all with experience in Kenya. And we know there are others here in the room, including Kenyans, who will want to have a voice in the conversation as well. So we'll get to you for sure in the course of the next hour and a half. The way we're going to proceed after I introduce these distinguished panelists is to have a bit of a discussion up here for about the first half of the 90 minutes and then go to you for your thoughts. And normally we say just your questions, but in this particular case, I think it's important to let people also voice a concern or an opinion or a view. And so as long as we can keep things moving, I'll invite you to do that. We'll get to that in just a moment. Immediately to my left is Professor Matt Caratenuto of St. Lawrence University. St. Lawrence University has a Nairobi campus. Matt has spent a good deal of time there. He's also spent a good deal of time doing field research on Kenya throughout his academic career. He's a native of New York and spent a lot of time up there at St. Lawrence University, but also spent a lot of time in Kenya. And his recent book is Obama and Kenya, Contested Histories and the Politics of Belonging. And so, I'm still holding out a little bit of hope that President Obama himself will feel the need to come in today and make a surprise appearance to comment on the book and or the elections, but I won't get our hopes too high just yet. Immediately to Matt's left is Lauren Blanchard, who started the IRI, the International Republican Institute field office, back 15 years ago in Kenya, but has for the last decade been at the Congressional Research Service, covering a wide range of issues and countries in Africa. One of our nation's real experts now on the subjects that are of interest to us today, and again, with a great deal of field experience in Kenya itself, also a broader perspective on U.S. policy towards Africa, which is clearly part of the discussion today as well. We're looking first and foremost to understand the elections, the stakes, and what they mean for Kenya, but obviously we want to think about what Kenya means for the United States and what potential influence, to the extent that's appropriate, the United States may have on Kenya's future as well. So understanding the various interactions, the various interlinkages in both directions will be important, and Lauren can help us a great deal with that, as can the final panelist, John Tomaszewski, also of IRI, and he has essentially, in a sense, succeeded where Lauren left off, although I guess there was a gap in between. He spent about 3 years in the Nairobi East Africa office of IRI up until just a couple of years ago and is now based in Washington, where he has responsibility for a number of countries in Africa from the point of view of IRI, which, as many of you know, is an organization like the National Democratic Institute, which is involved in strengthening political parties, trying to help encourage various elements of democracy in countries around the world. From the point of view not of picking sides, not of picking favorites, but of trying to strengthen various organizations, trying to support electoral reforms, trying to get more voices into various democratic debates around the world, including, most importantly, today in Kenya. Just one more word before I then go to Matt and start the conversation. I think you're all aware of the importance of Kenya. It's a country that we all think a lot about when we think about Africa and the United States, but let me just frame a couple of points to remind those of you who may not be specialists. Kenya is, I think, the sixth most populous country in sub-Saharan Africa, and that makes it one of the biggies, one of the pivotal states. Along with Tanzania, which I think is just narrowly ahead of it in population, it is the largest, most populous country in East Africa, and only Nigeria and South Africa, DRC, and Ethiopia are larger in population. Kenya is pivotal for the security role it plays in East Africa. It, of course, is right next to Somalia. It is very close to a number of other countries in the region that are afflicted by various kinds of conflict and challenges, including, of course, the two Sudans. And it has its own major challenges. But Kenya has a lot of promise. Kenya's been growing economically pretty well for quite a while. Kenya has shown a great deal of ability to diversify its economy, to strengthen its economy. It has a very vibrant young population, very full of promise. And so at this juncture, remembering that a decade ago, the last time we saw a big election cycle in Kenya of this magnitude, there were a lot of problems and quite a bit of violence and more than 1,000 people ultimately killed and perhaps some major setbacks in some areas of Kenyan democracy. We know this moment has a lot of promise, but also some peril. And that's why we're here today. So without further ado, I thought I would turn to Matt first to ask him to do a little better job than I just did of situating this moment in the history of Kenya and trying to just understand how Kenya's come through recent decades in the evolution of its democracy and its political system since independence, and just how he sees the magnitude and importance of the elections today. Matt, over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Mike, and thank you all for coming this morning. So as a historian, I definitely would echo some of Mike's points about Kenya being a regional center of sort of political and economic activity in East Africa. It has its rivals in terms of competing for that status in the region, but it is an important kind of strategic and economic partner with the U.S., the U.K., the European Union, and increasingly China. And so those are issues that are all at play in the sort of kind of broader significance of this. From a historical perspective, 2017 is also the 60th anniversary of Kenya's national electoral process. Really from the first kind of national election in 1957 all the way up until the last elections in 2013, we've seen kind of Kenya's democracy evolve in with some key trends at play. One, if you think about it from the perspective of independence from 1963 to 2002, it's important to remember that Kenya was ruled by one political party for that entire time and only two presidents. So that time was kind of marked by really a period of autocratic rule that set a precedence moving forward of thinking about kind of national level politics and elite politicians controlling the national scene through kind of the politics of regionalism and perhaps the politics of identity or ethnicity. So, and then also that 40-year period in Kenya's early history kind of set a tone for the power of the presidency in Kenya, which has been a very contested political issue and is certainly at play at this election. It's sort of what role, how much power, what centrality to the political process is the office of the president. It is the sixth election, 2017, since the reintroduction of multi-party politics in 1991, which was sparked by local protests and international pressure, where the government was forced to return and open up a de facto and a de jure one-party state in 1991. Three of these elections, 1992, 1997, and as Mike mentioned, 2007, have seen electoral-related violence with 2007, 2008, seeing the most extreme levels of that, with over 1,000 people killed and 600,000 internally displaced. And that election is very much on the minds of Kenyans today and the lived experience of that. There are still internally displaced people within the country that have not returned to their homes and not been fully back reintegrated into their own communities. And so this is very much at play, both the memory of it, but also the lived experience today. What we know about this kind of electoral violence is that it is well organized, it is often state-sponsored, and it is fueled by regional and historical claims of inequality, whether it's on development issues, whether it's on access to land, unequal distribution of resources, which really date all the way back to the colonial period, and many of those issues have been unresolved up until the present. And so Kenyan elections, and particularly this election, are both kind of referendums on the present and the future, but also ways to debate and still contest issues from the past. Other elections in 2002 and 2013 were relatively peaceful, but were still dogged by claims of voter intimidation, voter suppression, and electoral manipulation. And so those are also issues that Kenyans are talking about and wanting to think more about. 2017 is also the second election since the new constitution was passed in 2010 by a national referendum, and support for this document was principally aimed, I think, at checking the supremacy of the power of the presidency and distributing much of the power, or attempting to distribute much of the centralized power of the central government into 47 new counties, which replaced really the outdated colonial infrastructure of the provincial administration, where Kenyans really weren't voting for their regional representatives in the national government. Those are being appointed by the Office of the President. So Kenyans are voting for new positions for the second time, and I'm sure we'll talk more about the implications of that, particularly on the local level. And if you think broadly, just briefly about the candidates themselves, I mean, Uhuru Kenyatta, the incumbent, and Raila Odinga, the challenger, are both well-known in the political scene. These are kind of scions of political dynasties in Kenya, sons of both the first president and vice president of the country. They're known throughout the country. None of these candidates are new in the political scene, even though Uhuru Kenyatta, I believe, is 16 years younger than Raila Odinga. And they both lead coalitions, regionally based coalitions across the country, and are in a tight race. Uhuru Kenyatta is running on his record as a president, which is attempting to deliver on sort of big development projects, focusing on economic growth, focusing on regional security issues. Raila Odinga is positioning himself as a candidate for change, although he's been in government for quite some time, and thinking about government accountability and really trying to make this a referendum on the 2010 Constitution and its efforts to really implement that fully. So that's kind of the broader kind of stake, from I see it as a very brief introduction from the perspective of a historian.
Excellent. Let me ask a follow-up before we go to Lauren. So President Kenyatta has now been in office for 15-ish years, ballpark?
In terms of, he was elected in 2013, but he's been around since 2002, really,
okay.
In electoral politics.
Yeah. And as you say, Odinga's been on the national scene now for 15 to 20 years. Mm. Could I just ask you to explain a little more about, you mentioned that Odinga would like to frame this as a referendum on the Constitution of 2010, presumably on, as you say, democratic accountability and, everything that's gone on in Kenya, for better and for worse. Can you sharpen that a little bit more or give some more detail as to what are going to be to the extent there are issues that influence the outcome of this election? And, of course, we know as Americans it's not always just the issues that intervene in a vote. But to the extent that issues are on people's minds, how are Kenyans thinking about the choice?
I think the word devolution is key in this. So this is a phrase that was often talked about with the 2010 Constitution and has been a major political sort of buzzword in Kenya ever since, devolving power from the presidency and particularly devolving the control of local resources from the national government level to the county level and then the even local level. And these are things that both candidates have said they're committed to. Although I think Raila Odinga is sort of claiming that Uhuru Kenyatta's and William Ruto are not delivering on that and that he says that he will deliver on that. And so there's that kind of pushback, at least from the opposition, that the ruling government right now is not as committed to that as they say in rhetoric. And the ruling government has delivered on certain issues, right? Access to civil service has improved. At the local level. They have completed some major development projects. The standard gauge railway improvement from Mombasa to Nairobi is their kind of key signature development project right now. Although projects like that are also dogged with claims of corruption or claims of cost overruns and issues of efficiency in government. And so I think this idea of who's in control of the national resources, whether it's going to be the president, whether it's going to be the checks and balances at the local level, are key kind of issues that are framing this debate.
Excellent. And so, Lauren, if I could go to you and just pick up in the same place, just ask you to explain what you see as the most important stakes in this election, the most important drivers of the choices being presented to the Kenyan voter, and as well as the national level and presidential level vote, how you see the importance of the devolution process.
So I think, as Matt described, politics in Kenya have historically been identity politics, politics based largely on ethnicity, where you're from, who your people are. And you'll often hear in the context of Kenyan politics a phrase called, it's our turn to eat. And that is largely how many Kenyan politicians, particularly on the opposition side, try to frame sort of campaigns. And if you think about, as Matt was describing, the period of one-party rule, this was largely a period controlled by the ethnic constituencies of the two presidents. the original President Kenyatta, who was a Kikuyu, and the his successor, his former vice president, Daniel Arap Moi, who was a Kalenjin. Right now, those two ethnic groups are represented in the party of the ruling party, the Jubilee Party, the younger President Kenyatta, and his deputy president, William Ruto, who is a Kalenjin. So what the opposition is broadly trying to do, in addition to a number of its other campaign approaches, is to suggest that these two groups have largely controlled much of the piece of the pie in terms of Kenyan resources, and that it's another group's turn to eat. And you see with the opposition, which is now called NASA, you'll see that political parties change their names, particularly in the aftermath of the 2002 elections, when we really opened up to more active multi-party politics. So you find ethnically based parties that come together in coalitions, because you don't have one ethnic group that can actually sort of win the vote on its own. And these coalitions, they change over time. So you will see people move in and out. Deputy President Ruto, again, as I mentioned, a Kalenjin, was in the 2007 elections in the same party as Raila Odinga, who is now running against him. So you see these sort of changing, shifting sands among communities in Kenya. So what is at stake for the ethnic groups represented in the NASA coalition is they want their turn at controlling power. Now, devolution introduces an interesting dynamic, and there's an argument to be made about the slow sort of transition away from what they call zero-sum politics. Basically, the groups who have control of government, the ruling party, their home areas get more investment, have more opportunity for senior government jobs, senior civil service jobs, government contracts. You're probably all aware there is a great sort of legacy of large-scale corruption in Kenya, largely been unaddressed. You have many cases outstanding, 90s through the 2000s, that sort of continue in terms of procurement and really implicating individuals who have been in and out of government in both of the main coalitions right now. So I think what this election will be ultimately is to some extent, you will see people voting along identity lines. I think it will be also interesting to see to what extent they're voting along how they feel that the economy is doing for them, how they feel their community is faring right now in Kenya. Matt mentioned a number of major infrastructure projects, including this new railway. There are a number of new roads. Nairobi, the capital, has been transformed in the last 10 years. But to what extent do your average Kenyan voters feel that they are benefiting from that? How many of them can ride on the railway? How many of them who live outside Nairobi and off of these main highways are benefiting from these new infrastructure projects? How many people feel that unemployment is a bigger problem now than it was then? And to what extent do they feel that the Jubilee administration has done things to ameliorate their problems? We've seen food prices rising over the course of this year. That may play out in the election in ways that I think people who assume that people will vote strictly along ethnic lines could end up being surprised with in this election. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a great segue to JT, but before I do ask him to comment, and then he's got some polling information I know he wants to share as well. Lauren, I wanted to ask you about your overall take on Kenya's economy over the last 10 or 15 years. From a very, very broad 30,000-foot view, some people would say it's done pretty well, right? That it's actually had a fairly steady 5, 6, 7% growth, along with Ethiopia and a number of other African countries. It's had a lot better last decade or two than it ever did, let's say, in the years when I was in Africa in the Peace Corps in the 80s, and most of the continent was just struggling to get by with 1, 2% growth. So you have that. But as you just pointed out, you also have a situation where the benefits have been uneven and where there's still a big problem with corruption. How would you describe, if you were going to assess the net effect of Kenya's economic trajectory, where things are today?
Again, it's difficult. Kenya is, I think, right now the fifth largest economy in sub-Saharan Africa. It was fourth, but was recently overtaken by Ethiopia. I think that stings a little bit. But the Kenyan economy is one of the most diverse, arguably maybe the most diverse on the continent. It's not a resource-based economy. Multiple administrations have done, I think, a really excellent job of encouraging sectors of the service sector. There's a very impressive and vibrant technology sector in Kenya. Kenya really pioneered mobile banking. So there is a lot going for Kenya, and those things have trickled down, I think, in the to the Kenyan population, mobile banking in particular. So I think that there are a number of ways in which Kenyans are better off economically today than they were. The question is, Do they see it in comparison to sort of where they think they should be, and also in comparison to other people? Do they feel that the rich are getting richer while they are sort of by comparison not sort of advancing as quickly?
Go ahead, Matt.
Just add something very briefly. I agree with what Lauren was saying completely. And, you know, just from a very sort of minute detail, if the average person is dealing with in terms of, you know, high rates of inflation, you know, upwards of 10% right now, and that's been a historic average for quite some time, close to that. And just in this past year, you know, flour, unga, one of the staple goods that people eat, has been rising at 30%. And that's, you know, people are spending most of their income on food at the sort of local level. And so a 30% rise on a daily commodity is going to have a major impact on people's lives. And so we can't overestimate how that might play out.
And the demographic issue is, I mean, Kenya is not immune from the demographic boom that we're seeing on the continent right now. About 60% of the population is under the age of 24. Unemployment rate for youth is about 40%. It's higher than Ethiopia. It's higher than Uganda. Higher than Tanzania. These are huge issues. Successive governments have come up with schemes everywhere from a national youth type fund to national youth service to youth schemes on procurement. Some of these things work, some of them don't. Government isn't always the best solution to these problems because government has a corruption issue, an inefficiency issue. So those things also play into it. I also think that when you look at Kenya's economy and where it's going, it is the commercial gateway to East Africa. And if you have a bad election in Kenya, everyone in East Africa will get sick. Every other economy will get sick. Why? Because goods enter through the port of Mombasa. They are transported throughout that country. In 2013, you saw prices of shipping go up immensely for goods into Uganda, Rwanda. These are threats that exist, and that's why it's very important that a stable election occurs.
We also have a very substantial U.S. assistance program into Kenya, I believe upwards of half a billion dollars a year, and one of the largest recipients on the continent. So, and also in trade terms, does anybody have a good gauge? I'm sorry to just add this one question before we go back to your political analysis, but a rough sense of Kenya's importance compared to other African countries for the American economy? Have we, I mean, in terms of trade, this has been one of the major focal points, I think, for the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act going back a number of years and other such efforts. Is it fair to say this has sort of been a centerpiece of U.S. economic policy towards Africa?
Increasing trade opportunities has. Kenya hasn't taken advantage of AGOA as much as I think many people argue that it could. And it's, you know, it's not one of the largest trading partners for the U.S. on the continent. But to put Kenya in the context of sort of U.S. strategic interests, it is one of the most strategic partners on the continent, a longtime ally. It is the home to the largest U.S. diplomatic presence on the continent, and that's including North Africa and Cairo. So you have a very large diplomatic mission, very large USAID mission. It is one of, if not the largest recipients of U.S. foreign assistance on the continent. And in parallel, it is one of the two largest recipients in sub-Saharan Africa of U.S. security assistance. It is a very, very important counterterrorism partner, very, very important partner in terms of being sort of an anchor state in an incredibly volatile region. Obviously, you've got Somalia to the north, South Sudan, Sudan, and Kenya is a regional hub for transportation and finance. And in the context of the upcoming election, and in sort of keeping in mind the violence that followed the 2007 elections, when the violence happened in Kenya, it happened along sort of the major transit corridors into Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and those economies took a major hit because goods were not able to transit from the port in Mombasa, and that violence went on for months.
Thank you.
And then just to add the China factor, I mean, we've talked about Kenyans trading out, but also trading in. I mean, China's at $5.9 billion in trade with Kenya, but Kenyans are only exporting to China $99 million. So that's a huge trade deficit. It's a huge market where the United States could do some real serious business, and it's not just about agriculture, it's about services. We've talked about tech. So I think it's a place where the U.S. could grow serious businesses in the future, of course, with a good government, creating a business-friendly environment, and that's always an issue, too, in that region.
So back to the politics and the elections. JT, if you could frame things as you see them, including the polling data that you've got, and also if you could say a word perhaps on IRI and other American agencies of various types and international groups that are trying to help Kenyans strengthen and develop their civil society and their democracy.
Sure, maybe I'll start there first. So there are a number of organizations. I mean, the UN headquarters, of course, are in Nairobi, Kenya, the only big headquarters in the southern hemisphere. And there are a number of organizations. So you have the whole NED family is there, National Endowment for Democracy family, SIPE, Solidarity, NDI, IRI. You have a huge organization, IFAS, which is carrying out a huge election assistance project funded by USAID. State Department also actively funds a number of big projects. Countering violent extremism, there's a number of pieces of programming ongoing. Very helpful, everything from working with police to really dealing with some of the divisions within society along the coast and recruitment of youth. There's a lot of economic empowerment work done through U.S. assistance where everything from, they used to have this group, the National Youth Bunge Association, Yes Youth Can. And that was a huge program where youth were essentially organized at a very local level and given skills about how to make businesses, how to be good citizens in in Kenya. And it has had a very important impact in terms of stability and improving the way that youth take up issues and challenges in society. So the U.S. assistance is really important, and there's a number of organizations. IRI has done everything while there. We've been there for about 20 years, if not probably longer, off and on, since 92. It is true that Lauren helped open the office there, but during my time there, I worked largely on civic education. We had worked with political parties in the past. I mean, William Ruto used to come to our office and look at polls, and Uhuru Kenyatta would come to trainings and learn about, party building. And Raila Odinga has, done a lot of work with us about election observations on the continent. NDI will be leading a very important election observation mission, as well as the Carter Center. So both of them will be very important U.S. institutions who will be looking at the vote, commenting on the vote, and providing good observation. And both of them have sound histories in the country. In terms of the dynamics of the politics of the election, a lot of people will try to handicap this race and have already said, Uhuru will get it. If he doesn't get it in the first round, he'll get it in the second round. There's also been a lot of shaming and sort of contradicting of polls. But just to put a little information out there, a poll that just came out looks at sort of the end of May poll that was done. Raila has closed the gap on Kenyatta, 47-42. That puts Kenyatta down from January in an Ipsos poll about 17%. Strategic on May 6th had a poll that sort of looked at Kenyatta at a favorable rating of 45% versus Odinga 37%. Zogby poll released just recently puts Raila ahead 47% and Uhuru 46%. That's pretty much a dead heat. Presidential elections are very competitive in Kenya. Of course, with Zogby, it's important to note that Raila employs him, but we know that they work well. And that's the other point of this. There's a lot of Western consultants, Cambridge Analytics, they're all there. They're all working. Sometimes they're not even liked. So while you hear the message about anti-Western sentiment, neocolonialism, trust me, there are British and American consulting firms feeding that message out the door. So let's not read too much into what's being said in the press. The media is very important. We see a lot of this playing out in the media, and the media will have an important role to play in how this election takes shape. It played an important role in 2007, 2008. In 2013, we saw sort of a well-moderated media with a lot of peace messaging and a lot of self-censorship. There's been some interesting media reforms since that last election that'll impact, how free journalists feel they can be in terms of reporting specific issues as they arise. This is a very important issue that has to be looked at, I think, as this election goes forward. There are a number of organizations watching media monitoring at the moment, and I think that'll be something that will take shape. We've talked a little bit about the county-level races. So 47 counties, One of the big things that IRI did was after the 2013 elections, you have literally 47 new governments out of nowhere. They didn't exist before. There were local authorities, poorly funded, highly corrupt, didn't have a lot of fiscal authority. Overnight, they were given a budget, and this is not like a local government. This is literally like a state. It's not federal, but certainly they would get minimum 15% national revenue would be split up between 47 counties. On average in Kenya since devolution, that has not happened. It's actually been higher, 25, 30. Looking at the finance bill that Uhuru Kenyatta recently signed, it's about 46, 47% next fiscal year. Huge amounts of money that have now gone down to the county level. You have a county assembly. Many officials who had never been assembly members, never worked in government, were immediately taught how to deal with budgets, development planning, figuring out how to staff up county assemblies. Governors were elected, didn't have offices to go into. I was once in Lamu after the elections, and the county assembly was meeting in the constituency development hall right next door to the governor's office with holes in the windows and everything. And it's been expensive because they've had to build all these buildings. They've had to hire all the staff. And the public wage makes devolution very expensive and thus brings back full circle into the politics of this election. How much devolution do we want? Well, the Constitution says do it as far as you can go. It's created a Senate. It's created these county governments. But there's been a lot of debate over this time. Have we gone too fast? Should we slow down? There's this interesting body following the 2010 Constitution and really was active in after the 2013 elections called the Transition Authority. This authority was supposed to be like the body that, you know, brought everyone into the county government's devolution, looking at properties, looking at certain ways in which the local authorities would adapt to the counties. These were big technical issues, and as a result, you saw governors and county-level people trying to fight for more functions, more authority. Kenya's constitution lays out a group of functions, agriculture, education. These types of functions, Kenyans wanted more of it at the local level, and there's been a big fight since the 2013 election about getting more of that down to the ground. But are Kenyans ready for it? As a result of healthcare going down to the county level, you have doctors saying they're not paid and nurses saying they're not being treated well and put in, and they want to be paid by the central government instead. So these tugs and pulls, I think, will have an important role to play as people make decisions about what they want in this election. And Raila Odinga has been, you know, generally classified as someone who's a big push for devolution. And, of course, the opposition lodges that Ruto and Kenyatta are holding back on devolution. I think it's a tough debate, though, and some of it's more rhetoric than it is reality.
Excellent. So I just have one more big question, two-part question for all of you, and then we'll just bring others in as well. And I guess I'll put it this way, just in the broadest terms, for somebody like me who was Peace Corps Zaire, and we've had a lot of events here over the years on DRC, this sounds like a fairly good set of problems to have in the scheme of things. I mean, obviously, tragically, Kenya got to the head of the newspaper headlines 10 years ago when it had a very tough election. But the country you're describing sounds to me more hopeful and promising than, and the election itself sounds more hopeful and promising than perilous, although I realize it's a little bit of both. And so I wanted to just put that proposition before you and see how you'd react. But to the extent that there obviously are concerns and that Kenya does have a long ways to go, I also wonder if you want to comment, if you wish, and it may be easier for some of you than others given your jobs, on U.S. policy options that we ought to be considering. To what extent are there things we can do more or less of or do differently that might either before or after the election improve the prospects for Kenya? That's a very big question, so it invites speculation, but you can also feel free to ignore it if you prefer. And Matt, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I mean, that's an important question. I think part of some of the things that we've been talking about this morning, I think, are direct response to maybe the ways that Kenya has been portrayed globally, particularly in media circles since 2007. I mean, now it's, if you see an article about the Kenyan election, it tends to be about ethnic arithmetic or quote-unquote tribal violence, and people are growing tired of that. But it's also not very nuanced. And I'll take an example of the violence that has been happening in Laikipia County, in the central part of Kenya, bordering the northern kind of rangeland region. That's a very deeply historical issue. It's been portrayed as a colonial attacking white farms in a Zimbabwe-style fashion, and that's just not correct. These are are patterns of violence, patterns related to historic drought, patterns related to politicizing land claims at around election time, not having access to historic grazing grounds, fencing in the region. So it's very complex, and I think we lose some of that complexity of it. If we think about the kind of context of the Kenya elections moving forward, I mean, one of the things is that, you know, an incumbent has never lost an election, right, at a presidential level. And so that has pushed people to kind of already say that Uhuru and Ruto are going to win re-election. JT brings up some interesting stuff at the county level. When you look at the primaries that have happened, you've seen long-term, very famous politicians, you know, the brother of Raila Odinga losing a primary in his home area. Other, you know, sitting incumbents who you would have thought would have been a shoe-in for re-election 15 years ago are losing out those seats. So it's very interesting that you're voting for a governor in 2013 for the first time, but 2017 is the time when you're really putting the referendum on that. Now we understand what a governor might supposed to deliver to us, and we think that you haven't done it, or we are looking for a different kind of candidate. And so in terms of kind of the growth of democratic levels, I think the really exciting stuff and the things to watch for are not necessarily always at the national level, and they can be at the local level. In terms of U.S. policy, I mean, we haven't talked a lot about strategic partnerships. I think those have grown, particularly since 1998, and the embassy was bombed by al-Qaeda. But then in recent years with the al-Shabaab issue in Somalia, crossing over into Kenya, and then Kenyan military actions beginning in 2011 into southern Somalia. I think the U.S. Is supporting that, but what has been happening is there is a lot of issues in the northeastern areas of Kenya that have been overlooked in terms of the not just the election, but extrajudicial violence, insecurity, and the old adage that people used to say in going to northeastern Kenya is still really at play. There are several cities in northeastern Kenya, Wajir, Mandera, where you go there and people ask you, how's Kenya, as if you were not, you were leaving a different country. And so that inclusivity issue kind of moving forward, I think, has to be a priority of any, you know, bilateral relations or aid packages or strategic security initiatives, whether it's in Somalia, but it not at the stake of the Kenyan Somali population, right? And there are hundreds of thousands of refugees regionally in Kenya still. I mean, there has been talk of closing the Dadaab camp for quite some time. That population has shrunk, but there are still hundreds of thousands of people in that camp and well over 100,000 more. And I think I had the figures from, it's almost 500,000 from UNHCR in June, end of June, almost 250,000 in Dadaab, another 180,000 in Kakuma in the northern part. So the regional security aspect has to be a part of that. When things go bad in South Sudan, refugees come to Kenya. When things are not well in Somalia, refugees are coming to Kenya. And the same could be said about northern Uganda 15, 20 years ago, our drought issues in Ethiopia. So these are questions that have to have a regional context, I think, to play out.
Excellent. Lauren.
I mean, you have a really complex picture when you're looking at Kenya. You have, in many ways, so many things that Kenya has going for it. It has arguably the most progressive constitution on the continent, maybe one of the most progressive in the world. It has arguably the most vibrant civil society on the continent. It has, in comparison to certainly every other country in East Africa and arguably in a large part of the continent, one of the freest media in the world, on the continent, excuse me. But there are buts. This is a tight race, and this is a race in which, at the highest levels on both sides, the rhetoric is at a level that it's about 99%. The opposition claims that already the ruling party is rigging the election, and they repeat these claims again and again, publicly and in rallies. The Jubilee coalition, the Jubilee party, by comparison, suggests that the opposition is fomenting chaos and that a vote for NASA will be a vote for violence. And there are some really scary advertisements that are floating around on social media. There has been an increasing use of hate speech. One MP arrested, I think, just today on allegations of hate speech. And that's happening both at the national level and in terms of local races. You've seen a lot of hate speech in the context of the violence that Matt was talking about up in Laikipia. You have security situations in parts of the country, particularly up in the upper northeast area along the Somali border, where you have the Kenyan military deployed internally. There are some questions about how that's going to affect people's ability to vote. The Election Commission right now is having trouble staffing the polls in Lamu County, which is, again, in an area where you've seen an uptick in potential al-Shabaab activity. You also have the Kenyan military deployed in Laikipia. So these internal military deployments sort of add to some of the concerns that have been raised about the role of the security forces in the elections. Back in the 2007 election, post-election violence, the Kenyan police were attributed to, I think, having killed as many as 400 people and wounded many more in the context of sort of dealing with some of the violence and going beyond. The Kenyan police, unfortunately, have accrued a bit of a track record of allegations of extrajudicial killings. And that's not to say that there haven't been incredible improvements. And I think going back to the 2010 constitution, Kenyans, I think, really have come quite far. The 2010 constitution, the referendum on that, was an incredibly important and, I think, watershed moment. And the peaceful nature of the 2013 elections is also worth keeping in mind. You know, we talk about the 2007 post-election violence, but it's not the most recent election that Kenya has had. Kenya has held a peaceful election since then. And I think you have to acknowledge a number of the advances that the Election Commission has made and the new commissions. You have a National Cohesion and Integration Commission that tracks hate speech and has really worked to mitigate some local tensions in various parts of the country. So, you know, I think in many ways, Kenya is and continues to be, to some extent, a good news story in terms of democracy. And I think the Kenyan government and the opposition really want to sort of continue that progress. A peaceful and smooth election is very, very important to Kenya's continued economic progress and to continuing to attract investment. I think, again, the stakes are high. It would be quite helpful if both parties would, in the coming weeks, ratchet down the rhetoric and sort of really highlight, talk of peace and acknowledging that, you know, if these elections are credible, that they will sort of go through the court systems and that you will have both a peaceful and a credible election. But that has somehow, those two elements, peaceful and credible, have somehow sort of, at least in the public narrative, been sort of put in contrast. If you don't have, there's focus on a peaceful election versus focus on a credible election. And so I think as the United States and other donor countries and those who are involved in monitoring the election are looking at this period and what may happen afterwards, focusing on both of those elements. Peaceful and credible election, I think, is very critical. Keeping in mind the role that this election plays, not just in Kenya and in terms of Kenya's democratic trajectory, but what it means for the region. This is a region, East Africa, where you've had a lot of democratic backsliding, and you've had democratic backsliding in a number of areas, other areas on the continent. If we look to Nigeria, which had a very successful transition of power from a ruling party presidential candidate to an opposition candidate back in 2015, that was a very critical moment, not just for Nigeria, but for the broader region. And so I think that that's what people will be looking at when they look to the...
Before going to JT, just a quick follow-up, Lauren. I want to make sure I understand. This is sort of a nuanced point, but you talked about hate speech. You talked about allegations of vote rigging. You talked about some of these kinds of concerns. And we know about the history of how some of the violence has occurred in Kenya and also the way in which ethnicity has played a role. But it sounds, please tell me if you think I'm getting this wrong, it sounds to me like the hate speech, the vote rigging, this is more at the level of individual politicians, but there may be ethnic echoes. In other words, it's not fundamentally about one ethnic group attacking another. It's about political competition among individuals that may then have implications at the ethnic level if it's not properly handled. Is that a fair way?
Yes. And the challenge with the hate speech is that there are a lot of historic grievances, many of them ethnically based in Kenya, communally based. You had in the aftermath of the 2007-2008 violence, a Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation, which put together an incredible report, with allegations, and there have been numerous commissions that have done similar exercises, where they have talked about the grievances of these various communities in the Northeast, in the Rift Valley, Valley. Every community has its issues. Some of them, you know, sort of more recent in terms of the 2007-2008 violence. And I think one of the challenges is that many Kenyans don't feel that these grievances have been addressed, not by politicians, not in the courts. And I think that is an undertone of these elections that comes out in terms of land competition, and it comes out in sort of a number of different ways. It's you're seeing it play out in Laikipia, among other areas, seeing it play out in the coast, overlaid with the threat of Al-Shabaab.
A real quick follow-up. I mean, you know, I think that there's a little nuance to the narratives of peace that we have to be careful of, right? So this notion of sort of peace outweighing everything, including justice, is something that people have been complaining about. And I think there has been some critiques that the narrative, at least from the government, about peace has sort of quashed any sort of criticism of protest. Peaceful protests have been met with police violence on many occasions in the last couple of years, whether it's about the Electoral Commission. And so this commitment to a peaceful election is very important, but there's also a very important role that the institutions need to play. And we saw the Supreme Court kind of weigh in 2013, didn't really establish themselves as a true check to the presidency in ways that I think the Constitution gives them that kind of power. And so it'll be very important if this, as tightly contested this election is, that Kenyan institutions that are designed to check any of these kind of political claims actually come through and deliver.
Excellent.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you look at social media history, if you can go back to 2013 in a time machine, you would see the big things that were being talked about after the election while the Supreme Court case was going on was peace, no justice, peace, no justice. Half the country didn't want this president. The Supreme Court's taking forever to make a decision. It took forever for our results to come in. There's a lot of spoiled ballots. This all doesn't sound right. This all doesn't smell right. Decision comes out. Aside from ruling that Kenyatta was elected and ruling, you know, that everything should move forward as is, there were some instructions in the ruling that talked about key reforms that needed to happen. And some of those things happened in Kenya fashion, last minute, right? There was an election amendments bill that was sort of pushed through. But this is very important going into this election, because as we thought about peace, no justice, it is really in this election about peace and credibility and justice. It's all sort of wrapped together. I don't think, I think a lot of people talk about this as a rematch, but really isn't a rematch. It's really about the next phase of Kenya's history. We now have devolution settling into the country. In 2013, you still had two Kenyas, clearly two Kenyas. You had Nairobi and everything else, largely. Now you're starting to see Tarmac Road in Isiolo. The Diocese of Lodwar no longer runs the schools fully in Turkana. You now have, you know, county governments stepping up and developing places that have never been developed. I think there's going to be a superhighway in Kisumu. I mean, we just have not had these types of things. Now, Jubilee government will take credit for this, and they rightly should. But devolution should also play a key role, that it's the process of allowing governments at a local level, people, to make decisions about what they want in their communities through local elected leaders. And I think that's why what's different about this election from 2013 is the level of competition is so high. In this election, you have 14,000-plus candidates. That is unbelievable, running for about 1,800-plus seats, give or take a few seats. So in some constituencies, some wards, you have 30 people running for one seat, you know, trying to garner votes of maybe 50, 60,000 people. I mean, that is just something that we have not seen in Kenya ever. And I think it's a liberating prospect for youth and women who've largely been marginalized. This is something that IRI has been working on at the county level, looking at those barriers that youth and women have really been facing in the run-up to elections. And we're seeing races. I mean, you have a woman-on-woman race in Kirinyaga County. You have the Iron Lady, Martha Karua, former presidential candidate, right? Everyone knows Martha Karua, running against NY Guru, former devolution minister. The fact that you have sort of two big heavyweights, two women, facing off in a governor's race is a big change in Kenyan politics. So these are things that we need to look at, I think, as we move forward.
My colleague Emily Terry showed me a ballot, and I guess they're very nicely laid out. There are six different choices each Kenyan's going to make at various levels of government.
Yeah, it used to be three. So
it's going to take a while.
Yeah, it's going to take a while.
So thank you for that's an excellent introduction and explanation of what's at stake.
Now I'd like to involve the audience, and a little differently than in some Brookings events, where I do want to just sort of take 10 or 15 minutes to get a number of views and questions from you. I just will ask and plead that you be succinct, but we will also invite people to voice a couple of their concerns or thoughts as well as questions, given that we have an audience with a lot of expertise. So I'll ask my fellow panelists up here to take notes as to whichever comments or questions they want to respond to, but now we're going to give the floor to you for 10 or 15 minutes. So why don't we begin here with the woman in the yellow dress, and we'll go to the gentleman in the front row, and then work our way over, and then we'll come back.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rosemary Seguero. I'm a president of Hope for Tomorrow, an organization based here and in Kenya. Our organization observed election in 2013 election in Kenya. And in 2007, my nephew was killed in the election because he was one of the official returning officials. So he was shot and dead. So that's why I had to observe election. We observe election protecting, focusing conflicts and violence, which is hate, crime, and hate, in tribal conflicts during elections. So looking at your presentation, and thank you so much for talking well about my country. Kenya now is digitalized. Kenya is one of the African countries with digital. And everybody, including my old mother in the rural area, is a media person, is an informer. So it's not like previously where we didn't have anybody. People were got an awareness. People were doing a lot of stuff. Right? But now I will hear information here in the U.S. from my mother. This is what is happening. From here, I'll call somebody. So everybody from the rural area of Kenya up to anywhere in the world, we know what is happening in Kenya. So I think Kenya has changed looking at digitalization and actual people who are common people, because they were never informed of what is happening. Now that everybody has a cell phone and they are listening to the cell phone, getting messages, I think this election, looking at previous elections, will be a good election. And looking also at the economy, the politicians are fighting. Between the start of election, you would have been very, very big conflicts and violence. It's there, but it's not as previously because of everybody's communicating. Everybody's talking internationally. When they call, people are calling the Congress, the ministers all over the world. So the politicians themselves, from the minister, the presidents who are doing election, I think they are informed of from the local people, and people are aware of what is happening. So I think Kenya would be a good election. So I thank my country, Kenya, and I pray that there'll be no violence, even if I'm not going for election observation now. And you are there. We are encouraging businesses in Kenya. Kenya is the best country, as you have said, in the world. So
thank you. Thank you. And here in the front row, please.
Brooklyn, thank you very much. You had a very impeccable panel, and your analysis is very clear. I very appreciate. I just wanted to...
Would you identify yourself, please?
A little conflict of interest. My name is David Gashero, Deputy Chief of Mission, and good. I serve at the pleasure of the President. So
thank
just
you for
a disclaimer there.
Yes.
I wanted to talk one point on trade. I just wanted to bring to your attention to the audience that the private sector, I think, is ahead of the government in this sector. The private sector is already there. We have two of the largest construction companies in Nairobi now. We have Bechtel, we have Acom there, we have IBM. We have the only Watson headquarters in Africa, in Nairobi. We have IBM, we have Dell, we have Microsoft, and other companies are there. So if you, what I would ask is that when you go to Kenya and you want a source of information where things are, it's also good to contact your American companies who are already there on the ground, who have a lot of information on the ground. The other factor that I think is very, very important to notice, and I'll test my sister here, what she said, the voters in Kenya now are very informed. And to your point, Matthew, when you say that there are a lot of incumbent people who are removed this time, that there was the biggest fear in the beginning of the elections was voter apathy. And if there's anything that eliminated voter apathy, it is the empowerment of the voter to realize that for once now, leaders are not being imposed to them at the devolved unit level. So the voters were able to remove, in some counties, all the administration in the previous government were removed. That by itself empowered a lot of people. And I'm talking on the Jubilee side, I think the president made a conscious decision and told the people, I'm not siding with anybody you want to choose. choose the person you think has helped you or has done something to you. That by itself empowered a lot of people. So a lot of people, to your point, again, on at local level, at devolved unit, is that people are empowered, people are informed, people are tired of violence. We won't remove this uncertainty during elections time. It's a one-day event that come and go, and it is beyond any one president or the other. So that's one of the points I want to raise. The other issue of credibility, peaceful elections, they are mutually inclusive. The credibility and peaceful elections, they are mutually inclusive. And I want to show you data. We have 5,000 people, 5,000 observers right now confirmed, and more are still being credentialed right now. We have EU observers. We have John Kerry with the Carter Institute going there. African Union is already there. They met both opposition and the government yesterday, and they are confident with IEBC. Your question as to what can you do as a panel here to build that credibility is advocating for electoral system independence. To me, the cardinal thing of this issue is make sure that we all support the IEBC and where it has come from. We know we have 19.6 million votes. We know the registry is online. You can download it up to the presidential, to the local level. You can see how many votes are there for the governor in each county. It's there. It's on the system. In terms of security of the system, they have experts from IBM, Dell, and Oracle who are protecting the system for data integrity. The voting has each member of the party will have a representation on each polling area. We have 40,000 polling stations in the country. And the maximum voting people on these counties are about 700 people. So the long queues that you had in 2013 are not going to be there. So I think to me and to your point that we might have a very credible, peaceful elections in Kenya. And I think it's only fair at this point to at least showcase how much progress the IEBC has come through. They did a very good press conference this morning challenging the latest, and they challenged the people. Where do you think they could happen? But 5,000 people in the country as observers cannot fail to miss any problem. The system, the integrated system for choosing they are put in, has also inbuilt auditory system. Any vote about it can be threatened.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Gentleman back here, and then I'm going to swing to the other side for a couple more. No, over here first. No problem.
Okay, my name is Don Dakin, and I'm a retired lawyer here in D.C. In 1964, I went to Kenya as part of the first Peace Corps group that went to work in Kenya. We were settlement officers. We helped to redistribute 2 million acres of land that was owned and operated by white people, mostly from the U.K. and South Africa. And we settled Africans on these lands. And my question is, was any of the violence, the recent violence, related to Kikuyu people being settled in the tribal lands of other tribes during that resettlement process?
So hold on to that question. I have a couple more folks involved over here. The woman in the third row, and then we'll go to the second row for the last two, and then back to the panel.
Morning. That was a very wonderful panel. I enjoyed that. Very well informed. My name is Damaris. I am a Kenyan. I am a global scholar here at Brookings at the Center for Universal Education. I want you to comment on the issue of on the role of non-state actors in the coming election. Three of them. One is the role of the media. Kenya has a very vibrant media, very free media. But recently, there has been a lot of bitterness in Kenya because the media is spearheading public discourse about peace, 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 and nobody is talking about social justice. Nobody is talking about equality. Kenya is one of the most unequal societies I know. And so there is that kind of discourse that is going on that why are we talking about peace and nobody is talking about all these other inequality issues that plague the Kenyan society. Then I wanted you to comment on the role of civil society organizations. I think you made a comment that Kenya has had very vibrant civil society, but in the last 5 years, I think I could rightly say that civil society is on its knees. Remember the evil society discourse that has been going on, and I know I work with civil society organizations. I said I'm a professor in Kenya, but I direct a gender institute at Egerton University, so I work directly with civil society organizations, and I know a lot of civil society organizations are on their knees because of the branding of evil society, and actually there's been a lot of bad things going on there. Then lastly, the role of churches. Kenya is a highly religious nation. 82% claim to be Christian. And Christian churches are organizing prayer rallies all the time for peace, and no one is organizing prayer rallies for social justice. I just want you to comment on that. And lastly, hate speech. Yes, the National Integration Commission is working so hard, and I think as an observer of the Kenyan situation, there are nuances this time. We are not seeing so much hate speech, but if you go to the blogosphere, it's like a war zone. And supporters of Uhuru Kenyatta are abusing supporters of Raila Odinga and vice versa. And it's like poison. It's horrible. I just wanted you to comment if the fact that people have this space to ventilate is going to take away the real physical violence, now that people can scream at each other, call each other names. Do you think that's taking away a possibility of physical violence? Lastly, fake news. What's the role of fake news in this election?
Thank you. Please, Harry Carter, and then we'll to the gentleman, and then we'll go back.
Hi, my name is Carter Banker. I'm with the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy. My question is pretty similar to the last one that she asked, and it sort of touches on the role of technology that has been mentioned. A couple of people were talking about this positive role of technology in informing people during this election. But again, we've also been talking a lot about hate speech, and I'm just thinking about this recent election we've had in the United States and the role that fake news played and in elections all over the world. I mean, you had the gubernatorial election in Jakarta. It's a huge phenomenon in Indonesia that they have these WhatsApp groups and people just sort of forward them, forward information that isn't verified on to different people. And I'm sort of wondering if you could comment on the potential negative aspects of all of this access to technology in relation to hate speech and the election.
Great, thank you. And then last one here.
Thanks. Hi, good morning or afternoon. I'm Steve Rukin. I'm with the State Department, recently returned from a tour at Embassy Nairobi a short while ago. Just a couple quick questions. First, do any of you buy into the argument that, as some people have put forth, that devolution could lead to increased violence during the elections because of higher expectations among the populace? A second question would be the role of Al-Shabaab. Kenya, as you mentioned, has troops in Somalia. And the question would be, if Al-Shabaab were to be able to stage an attack in the run-ups or even during the elections, would that have a major impact on the elections, in your view, or not? And then the last question would be refugees. It seems to me, at least, that refugees haven't been a huge issue in the election, in the campaign, at least as big as it could have been. And what's the reason behind that? And do you expect refugees to become a major issue after the elections? The government hasn't moved lately on its recent rhetoric to close the Dab. So do you expect a change after the elections, perhaps? Thanks.
Excellent. So we have plenty on the table. I think it's time to go back to the panel. And please don't feel obliged to cover everything. And individually, please be very selective on which of the roughly 10 questions that are on the table you choose to address. Why don't we start with you, Matt?
Okay, so technology, interesting question. I mean, we talk about M-Pesa and things like that, where Kenya is revolutionizing mobile banking. That's very much transformed rural economies, connected people. You know, I too get you know, text messages all the time from friends in rural areas that, you know, 10 years ago wouldn't have ever have happened. But there is a danger in that. I mean, there's been some good research on the 2007 election violence, where rumors, mass text messaging, spreading both kind of insightful hate speech, but also the kind of fake news stuff that we're seeing. I know I am on several Kenyan political Facebook groups for research purposes, and some of the things that come across there are very alarming, right, and highly incredible, and are being shared again and again and again. And so that access to technology is something that is quite important. You haven't seen candidates and the political situation talk too much about that, at least on the kind of, you know, big stage. Maybe privately they're talking about it. But I do think that is an issue kind of moving forward. In terms of the IEBC, I mean, you know, the credibility of Kenya's elections is very much going to be a referendum, I think, on the, you know, International Elections and Boundaries Commission. They don't have a good reputation right now. I think amongst the general populace, there's not a lot of faith and confidence in that institution to be free and fair. It remains to be seen. You know, maybe reforms have happened, but they need to be implemented and shown in this election. I think if that happens, there will be a return of level of confidence in that institution. But right now, it is at pretty low levels. Other things, I mean, the land claim issue, which was brought up, is still very much a big issue. There was a land commission that was implemented in 2012 that yes, some title deeds have been given to local people who did not have, you know, legal access to that land. However, lots of land claims are still at play. In terms of the 2007 election violence, land issues were a central key to that, particularly in the Rift Valley. Those were areas where migrants from other regions were sort of targeted as not being quote-unquote indigenous to that land. That goes back to the colonial period. It also goes back to the land transfer after independence, which was done primarily on a willing buyer, willing seller basis, which allowed for really the middle class and upper class Kenyans to band together in large buying companies and buy large tracts of land around the country, where the poor across the country did not gain access to land, even though if you look back at Kenya's transition to independence, those individuals were the ones that were risking the most to gain that access. So that has been an issue. There has been some progress on that, but I think that is still in the question kind of moving forward. A little bit on the social media side, that's actually an interesting part. You are seeing Kenyans using social media to check hate speech and to really push back. So right in 2013, when CNN... had their hotbed of terror question on framing the Kenya, or is that 2015, sorry, when Obama was preparing to visit. Kenyans attacked CNN on social media.
KOT.
Right? And CNN caved, right? Kenya is a big market for them, right? I think a vice president came to apologize, right? That was a moment. There's also been several politicians who have made public hate speech, who have been immediately attacked on social media, and then brought to at least public shame. But this kind of level of impunity, I think, is something that we haven't really talked a lot about, but there has been a culture of impunity at the highest levels. And one of the things is, you know, if there is evidence of hate speech or evidence of violence, what does the Kenyan institutions have to actually prosecute at the highest levels? We remember that Uhuru and Ruto also were put up on charges by the ICC in the past. Those have been dropped, right? But there is still a lingering issue that has not been solved locally, I think, of who is responsible for this violence going back into the past.
Thank you. Lauren.
Trying to figure out which of these to tackle.
All important.
They're all important. Let me start briefly with, Steve, your questions on devolution potentially increasing the potential for violence in al-Shabaab and the refugees. Briefly, and I have a feeling JT may have some comments on this as well, there has been, I think, probably even more so than until recently, the talk of post-election violence in the context of the national election, a lot of concern about the potential for violence at the local level. Obviously, these are hot elections. There is a lot at stake at every level, and particularly for the governor's races, even for the MCA races. I was out in Kenya a few weeks ago now and heard a lot about the increasing use of, I'm going to call them political thugs, but every politician has their armed security goons, is another word. Yeah, everyone has them. at the local county assembly level, they have them. So you have enforcers, you know, at every stage of the race. And I think that is worrying. I mean, we've seen, this isn't the first time that we've seen this violence play out. Before the 2013 elections, you had some significant violence up in Tana River, and that was over sort of jostling over sort of local political races. So I think that there is concern there, and I think there is also the concern for that type of violence to spread, to spark. Likewise, that could happen in Nairobi if you have, you know, there are various ways where violence could spread throughout the country or not. I don't want to sort of go too far down that road. In terms of al-Shabaab potentially playing a role in the elections, we didn't see that in the last election. There was a lot of concern that al-Shabaab might try to somehow disrupt or influence the election. It didn't happen. We've actually, I think, seen some decline in al-Shabaab activity very recently. Obviously, they are historically, if you put them in context, very active during Ramadan. And we had a real uptick back in May and June of attacks. There have been some prominent reported attacks in Lamu County. And in response, the Kenyan security forces have sort of upped their presence there. And it's not entirely clear to what extent that has anything to do with the elections. I think the other challenge in terms of looking at al-Shabaab activity in particularly in the coast and the upper coast is trying to sort of figure out to what extent this is sort of national or sort of organized at the top by al-Shabaab versus local. You know, dating back to the attacks on the community in Pecatoni, you've got a lot of local sentiment there. That attack was ascribed to al-Shabaab, but seemed to have local participation and seemed to be targeting specific ethnic communities and religious communities had settled historically, you know, decades back in that part of the coast. So that plays out. Why we haven't seen sort of more movement against refugees, again, it's hard to ascribe motivation to the government on sort of when these anti-refugee and sentiments sort of come and go. I think there's been a lot of international pressure on the Kenyan government to comply with its obligations under international law. Also, you know, the Jubilee leaders have been campaigning heavily on the coast and in the Northeast. They want the votes. I don't think that they, you know, either side feels that it can afford to lose any constituency. This is very much going to be an election about turnout and turning out your own constituency, trying to pull as many away from your opponent as you can. And, you know, I think there's also a concern about potential suppression of the vote. And so I think in the context of al-Shabaab threats, there is a concern that an increased security presence, be it in the coast, in the Northeast, or in Laikipia, may have an impact on turnout. Evil society and Western influence. You know, this in the last election, I think we saw really some very dangerous trends that I'm afraid are going to play out, I see playing out again. There is a narrative that civil society is against the government. There is a narrative of Western influence in the elections. And, you know, this we didn't talk about this. The president and the deputy president faced ICC indictment. Their cases have now been dismissed for their role in the 2007-2008 election violence. And that was a major issue in the 2013 election. There were comments made by Western diplomats, U.S. diplomats, in the run-up to those elections that the candidates did not take favorably, and they used, I think, and were largely successful in campaigning on campaigning in part on a narrative that the West was trying to influence the election. I don't think that'll play as much of a role right now, but I do see worrying comments about the potential bias by Western governments, by Western election observation teams, and I think that's very worrying as we go.
I mean, I've already mentioned the consultants, you know, the ones that put out the message, the West is coming, the neocolonialists are coming, we need to hold them back. I mean, British PR firms and American consultants who are actually helping push these messages. And I've met a number of them. I would say that, you know, when we talk about this issue of hotbeds for the elections, Narok has a very interesting race going on there. I think you should look there for potential violence. If you remember, there's been a number of cases where tribal violence, it's also a hotbed for where there's going to be a lot of fighting for votes between Ruto's clan, Ruto's grouping and under Jubilee, and some of the inroads made by NASA through Isaac Ruto, who's aligned with Rilo Odinga's party. So there will be some fighting going on there. You also have an interesting race in Kisumu, and Kisumu will always have, I mean, I think in this election you'll see, just like you saw in the primaries, you'll see that as an area where you'll have some violence. And it's usually Luo on Luo, ODM on ODM, and that just stems from the fact that it's a big prize. It's one of the major centers. You know, Nakuru is another one, and that's one where we saw in 2007, 2008, a real place of massive violence, but there's also very competitive elections going on there. The level of competition is very high. Governors have a lot of money. They have a lot of influence. There are efforts to try to make governors hire more inclusively across the entire county, but they get to hire a lot of their own people, which means people from their community, and that can play an interesting role in that patronage system. So I vote for my guy or my gal gets in, and you know maybe I can get a job working somewhere in one of those government offices. There's millions of those jobs. Al-Shabaab, I think, you know, we've seen the government has made some comments about some of the recent attacks, that there may be some political reasoning behind it. Lamu is also another competitive election space, and the curfew there will play an important role in possibly suppressing voter turnout because, you know, if you have a curfew and there's attacks going on, Boni Forest is one of the sort of densely forested areas in Lamu, and that's where Al-Shabaab tends to hide, along with MRC and some of the other groups that we've seen. And you know, they train there, they collect themselves there. The government goes in there with soldiers. Al-Shabaab runs out. They do some things. They go back in. We talked about one of the ethnic enclaves in Pecatoni. It's a Kikuyu enclave. And when that attack took place, it was clear that there was some command and control not just happening from Mogadishu, but also inside the country. And that's worrying, that politicians would go to that level. But those are things that are looked at very closely by the security services. When we talk about the role that the U.S. and the U.K. play, I mean, they have done amazing work in helping the Kenyans improve their intelligence, improve the way in which they apprehend these suspects. They're working very closely in Somalia through AMISOM. That's why you hear a lot about drone strikes and some of the other things that the Americans are doing. They're working very closely with the Kenyan forces there. On my friend over here on Hopes for Tomorrow, I will just say that, you know, my grandmother-in-law, she's from Nyakach, and she barely speaks a word of English. It's just all Luo. But my wife, she translates for me, and she is a political animal, all right? And her cell phone is a little Nokia yellow screen thing that, you know, you could step on it and it wouldn't break, like my iPhone. Mm-hmm. And yes, it has transformed the way, I mean, Kenyans already are political animals. It's fun to watch the politics of Kenya. It is a blood sport, but it's also just fun rhetoric. It's almost interesting. I mean, a lot of people don't even believe it. They just kind of laugh, like, ah, you see what Raila did? Ah, you see what Uhuru did? You know, oh, Ruto, he's speaking at a church again. He's going to say something. So we see the theater play out. I think text messages, technology have opened up the way for that dialogue to take place. And groups like IRI, groups like NDI, groups like IFAS have all worked to sort of incorporate civic education into that. I remember after the election result in 2013, we made sure that working with the National Gender and Equality Commission and CIC, we were pushing out text messages. Just so you know, here are the facts. You know, the court case goes this way. This is what the Constitution says about Supreme Court. And this is what, you know, the role of the court is in this case, so that we're getting the right information to the people, bypassing the media, which can be quite expensive to access. The final thing would be just the issue of citizens and their engagement with IEBC. IEBC knew very well that they didn't handle 2013 very well at all. They've made a lot of reforms. They have a lot more work to do. I think Ezra Chiloba is a good executive director and has done a lot of work. He's a good spokesperson. He's a lot better than Isaac Hassan. And he certainly has put a lot of trust in to the people below him to get the work done. And that's why I think you've seen advanced deployment of a lot of this technology. We're looking at a Kenya, it's the Kenya Integrated Electoral Management System, or KEIMS. And if you follow the election, you'll know this word KEIMS gets talked about a lot. It's essentially the biometric identification process. Then when you vote, it'll capture the results and it will ultimately transmit results. It's everything wrapped into one. And they've learned their lesson from 2013, where transmission was delayed and created lots of problems. They've got satellite backups. They've got KEIMS systems backed up, three extra ones in each ward. They've hired all of these tech professionals who've gone down to the ward level and are ready and able to do it. But of course, they still have to hire fully the 362,000 poll workers. They all have to be trained, and they have to know what to do. And you know, listen, when you're hiring a student or an old MZ who's going to come out of the village and sit at the polling booth for the day, they don't maybe have the same level of education, and it's going to be a little tough to kind of comprehend all this information, all this technology. So that's something we worry about. We do hope that the training that the IEBC will do with these poll workers will be comprehensive, and also that civil society and poll workers from the political parties, the polling agents, will also know the process well enough to be able to hold each other accountable. I mean, that's the key thing here. Ryla wants to have, you know, 5 or 6 people, 10 people at every polling station. He's only going to be able to get one in. Why? Because they only let one in per party. So he's going to have his polling agent there. Let's hope that polling agent knows what they're doing and is able to say, hey, poll worker, you know, you should have done this, or I want to, you know, challenge the results here or challenge a process. And that type of dialogue is something that we promote, you know, around the continent as a key to peaceful elections.
Fantastic. Let's do a couple more, and then we'll wrap up here. So let's see, the woman in the red dress, please, and I'll take one, at least from the very back of the room. Gentleman in the red and white striped shirt, but please.
Hi, my name is Edna Lamayo, and I just recently moved back from Ethiopia. I was working for the Pan-African Chamber of Commerce, and I what your opinions on this. How has Kenya's progress in democracy affected or influenced its neighboring countries that aren't exactly democratic? And particularly in the case of Ethiopia, what does it say about, this is just your opinion if you have any, about the democracy before development argument? And great. To my brothers and sisters in Kenya, I know we've surpassed you in economic development, but you're always beating us in athletics, so you can't win everything.
That's debatable.
Please.
Hello, my name is Isaac Munene. I'm also Kenyan, but I'm a student at the University of Maryland in College Park. My question or my comments are, first of all, I think devolution has really had a very great impact in Kenya. And I think it sort of, it's had the impact of easing some of the pressure from the hot contestation at the national level. So I think that helps. I think the second thing that I really like to put across is that I think the U.S., government needs to do more work as far as strengthening the institutions in Kenya. The reason why people go on the streets or why people protest or why there's violence is because people do not trust that the institutions are going to work properly. So the U.S. government needs to do more work on strengthening the judiciary, the security services, even doing more work on the civil service. As far as the civil service is concerned, I think there's need for them to be seen as being neutral and that they need to be partners in governance and not as opponents. And that's what they are currently seen as. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, thank you. I guess we have time for one last question. So we'll go to the far back of the room, the gentleman in the hat, if we could, and then we'll have to conclude there.
Thank you very much. My name is Yaya Fanusi with United States of Africa 2017 Project Task Force. I'm 74 years old. The only time I get involved with African politics is during elections time. Everything you have said so most far is interesting, but really not that relevant to the real crucial issue of the people. After the Bible, Quran, for the people in Africa, including Kenya, is the ballot, one ballot. So you talk all this time, you're not talking about how the people see themselves and what is their concern. Their concern is their vote should not be tampered with, both on all sides. And when once you start focusing on that and see how you make sure that is correct, you will not have violence during the elections.
And since that was a comment, not a question, we will go to the woman here in the green sweater to finish, and then we'll go to you folks for final thoughts.
Thank you. My name is EJ, and I'm with Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. My question, could you expand a bit about the 47 counties and devolution? Are these 47 counties predominantly political units, or were they designed with some sort of physical or economic sustainable factors in mind? Thank you.
Okay, and let's just go down the panel. Actually, we'll start with JT this time and work the other way.
Yeah, I'll talk about that one, the last question. Devolution is an aggressive form of decentralization to transfer of specific authorities, administrative, fiscal, and political. These units, 47 counties, were sort of in some way predetermined in the Constitution, but the boundaries within these units are determined by the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, so they'll look at the wards, they'll look at the constituencies. But it does also try to take into account some of the issues of economic development and some of the traditional makeup of the country. There are border issues in these counties, and we've seen it in places like Elgeyo Marakwet and Nandi and Wasingishu. Potatoes are packaged here, then they go over here, and there's a lot of commercial issues, ethnic issues, right? The Meru are always having some issues with their neighbors, southern Turkana, and some of those different counties have border problems that have to be addressed. For Monene, I would say that in talking about what the U.S. needs to do more of, the U.S. is doing a lot and certainly does need to do more. I've been pretty open about my thoughts about U.S. assistance. I think it should be more long-term and more strategic. When you release the KEEP electoral assistance program 18 months to elections, that's not enough time. When you have an Ahadi contract that you give to a contractor, which is the big devolution package from USAID, what does it get you when it's so solely based on really providing commodities and not getting enough training and engagement? And so we would like to see more engagement of institutions where civil society is being strengthened, where we are trying to get civil servants to learn not just about their jobs, but also their role in this new government. And those are things that I think Congress is looking at, all the way up from the appropriations, and Lauren can probably talk a little bit more about that. On down into this community as we talk about Kenya. Kenya is important, and certainly the development work we do there, we need to do more of it. I would say, finally, in terms of, the electoral process overall, we still have a credibility issue with the way in which the media has handled this election, and it's something that I want to continue talking about, and something I think we haven't addressed a lot here. The media and WhatsApp and some of these other technologies have really had an impact on the way in which messages are spread by politicians, and it's something that we should be looking at.
Thank you, Lauren.
I'm going to start with Isaac's comment on the U.S. strengthening institutions. And personally, I couldn't agree with you more. The United States has invested a lot over the years in Kenyan civil society and Kenyan media, and I think that's important, but also investing in the institutions that these civil society groups are trying to hold accountable. I think the U.S. and other donors have tried to make inroads in that front, particularly in the context of devolution. Working on the institutional capacity, particularly of these new county assemblies, these governor's offices, this is going to be critical, but also at the national level. There is a lot to do in terms of, you mentioned the judiciary. Absolutely, absolutely more to be done. We talk a lot here in the West, and Kenyans talk about it as well, this problem with impunity and the lack of accountability and the lack of progress on accountability for political violence, police abuse, corruption, across the board. What is critical is, of course, strengthening the power of the judiciary to hold people accountable. And with the new 2010 Constitution, you have, I think, a greater ability to do that because you have a more independent judiciary. In terms of Kenya's influence in the region, this is a great question. I had a conversation the other day, maybe a couple weeks ago now, with a top Kenyan diplomat, and we were talking about South Sudan. And I think This speaks to Kenya's role in the region and its democratic evolution. There is a debate right now about the possibility of elections being held in South Sudan next year. I think many of you are aware South Sudan has been in a civil war now for several years. The country has been torn apart. Almost, I think, over a third of the population is displaced. Over half the population is in of, you know, extreme food aid right now. And the idea that elections could be held next year in Kenya, it's farcical. And yet you have several leaders in the region pushing for the idea, and of course the government in Juba pushing for the idea. And this senior diplomat said to me, there's no way. There's no way. Elections are not a box-checking exercise. And this is something that is understood across the country, and particularly in the context of the post-election violence in 2007. An election that is challenged, an election that is not credible, is not a stabilizing factor. It is a destabilizing factor. So I think, you know, that says a lot. Kenyans play an important and outsized role in the region. We talked about the strength of their civil society organizations and civil society actors. You see Kenyan civil society leaders in positions, in senior positions at the UN. Maina Kiai, who's the former UN Special Rapporteur on Peaceful Assembly. He's got a very long title, I think, but now is back in Kenya. You see the Kenyan civil society leaders cycle in and out of international institutions, of AU institutions. They play an outsized role in AU offices, AU Commission of Inquiry on South Sudan, UN Human Rights Commissions. You see Kenyan judges everywhere. So I think the role that Kenya and the model that Kenya sets for the region is very important. I'm going to avoid your question on democracy and development, lest I stray too much into an Ethiopia conversation.
in terms of development, just to say something as a historian, kind of thinking ahead, the 47 counties issue is very interesting in terms of devolution of development funds. I mean, we still see young people today, if they want to go to an urban area and get a job, where are they going? They're going to Nairobi. But the county levels are setting up maybe these smaller urban areas or smaller towns that now have some sort of impetus to get things off the ground. I mean, I went to Kitale in 2013, and I saw some of that happening already, right? Whether that's going to maintain itself is an interesting thing to follow. In terms of, the kind of progress of the election, right, you had 1992, you had election-related violence. 1997, you had widespread election-related violence. Okay, 2002 was a watershed moment. People celebrated that election both for its transition, the first time the opposition ever won an election in Kenya, right, and thinking that it was all over, like everything is going to move forward in a wonderful way. 2007 was a major setback. 2013, the narrative of peace outweighed, I think, some issues that were still at stake in that election. So that narrative of peace needs to happen. And, to be brutally honest, I mean, I work in an institution that has had a program in Kenya based in Nairobi since 1974. We have 17 full-time employees, Kenyan employees. We want peace and stability, right? But for Kenya to move forward, I think there has to be sometimes a messy process where some of those checks and balances get put into play and people are held accountable. And maybe some local elections or other elections are overturned and challenged in the court system. And that is really what I'm looking for, is the test in these institutions that were put in place, changed, reformed, particularly in the 2010 Constitution, and how they will stand up to this particular election and then those moving forward for progress.
Well, certainly in 2.5 weeks, we all wish the Kenyan people well in this important milestone in their development. I want to thank all of you for being here, and please join me in thanking the panel.